WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the Gulf War, American military women were deployed in larger numbers, in more types of jobs, and in positions closer to combat than ever before. They were the first servicewomen to fly helicopters on an air assault into enemy territory. They led chemical decontamination squads, serving alongside combat soldiers at the front lines. They flew refueling missions and worked as maintenance specialists. And they worked in Patriot missile battalions in both Israel and Saudi Arabia. We invited Carolyn Beecraft to talk with us about the new role of women in the American military. She's an expert on women's and family issues in the military. She established the Women in the Military Project for the Women's Research and Education Institute in Washington, D.C. She was an officer in the Army from 1966 to 1971. American casualties were remarkably light during the war, but early on in the war there was much speculation about what the American reaction would be when we saw women return in body bags. I asked Beecraft if she thinks Americans reacted differently to women dying than to men.
No. I think that the reaction to the body bags was always one of the things that those particularly that opposed increasing opportunities for women, that was one of their arguments. But we really haven't seen that over the last 20 years. Women have died in the military. Women have died in police forces, fire forces, and so forth. I think the American public understands that women that perform in these roles are doing dangerous jobs. They're there because they choose to be, and I think they respect that.
What were some of the logistical things that the military had to deal with that they've never had to deal with before because of the number of women?
I don't know that they really made any accommodations for the women particularly. The women deployed with their units. They didn't build separate dorms for them. They lived right along with the men. They ate along with the men. There was, I think, very little that was different for the military. I think the military women, though, were more kept to the bases than the men were because of the differences in Saudi culture. And I think maybe that was one of the probably the biggest culture shock for the women over there was operating in a Muslim culture.
What were some of the reservations that you think the military had before the Gulf about a battle situation in which men and women were together?
Well, I think this is an important historical time because it certainly has to puncture the myths. There were certain myths that if women were involved in military units that it would destroy the cohesion of the units, that men wouldn't fight if women were around. And another myth was that women wouldn't deploy because of children and so forth. Well, none of those myths proved to be true at all. The women did deploy. The cohesion appears to be as high as it ever has, and then men didn't act funny because women were around. And then you get into the point where you have different services that behave differently. For instance, the Army is used to deploying women, and so is the Air Force, because they have done it in Grenada and in Panama and in countless other operations in the 80s. The Marine Corps was the most reluctant and in the beginning was not going to send any women. They did, in the end, send a few women. I'm not quite sure how many. The Navy had women in ships in the Gulf, and it was a first for them. The Navy women were actually furthest from the battle scene, but they had many women that were serving on different kinds of ships. It was a first for them. So for all of the services, there were strides made.
Now, there are regulations in the services that keep women out of direct combat, yes?
There are two laws. There is no law that says that women cannot be in combat. This is kind of a common misconception, but there's no such law. There is a law that says that women cannot fly fighter aircraft engaged in combat missions, and then they cannot serve on ships designated as combat ships while they're engaged in a combat mission. That means that the women can't serve on aircraft carriers, destroyers, and frigates, although they did serve on supply ships and hospital ships. The Army has policies that says that women cannot be involved in what they call direct combat, And they defined that as closing with and destroying the enemy. So that essentially means women are not in the infantry, they're not in the armor, but they are in the units that supply support to the infantry and to the armor.
Would you like to see those regulations changed, and would you like to see women allowed in combat positions or at least closer to combat?
I think that the laws in the Air Force and the Army, the Air Force and the Navy should be repealed. I think they've outlived their usefulness. They have their roots in World War II when you had a different kind of battlefield. Getting rid of these laws would not necessarily open up the infantry. That's a common misconception and misperception, and that's not true.
So you'd still like to see women kept out of hand-to-hand combat?
I think that physical strength is a legitimate criteria for closing, just as mental ability and physical ability are legitimate criteria for specialties. And the infantry and the armor require a high degree of physical strength, particularly upper body strength. There are some women that would meet that criteria, but most women would not.
But as far as flying a bombing mission, you think a woman could do that as well as a man? It's not about physical strength to fly a plane and release bombs accurately.
Exactly. Well, women are fighter pilots in Canada and in Denmark, and there'll be other nations. And even our U.S. women, some of them in the Navy, do fly those fighter aircraft because they train men in them. But they can't fly them in combat missions. They would like to, too, by the way.
Do you think that women's performance in the Gulf War will move women a step closer toward getting more equality in combat positions?
I think that it will. I think because when you talk about the discussion, you can't talk about the theory, the what-ifs. They have solid experience that demonstrates the capabilities of the women and their ability to work well with the units. So we move beyond the what-if to the, well, this is the way it was, this is the way it is. And that's a very important psychological jump.
I think one of the things that set the Gulf War apart from other wars on the home front was that we watched women leaving their young children behind as they shipped off to the Gulf. And in many instances, we watched mothers and fathers, you know, within the same family, having to leave their children in somebody else's custody so that they could go off and fight. Could you explain what the military policy is for parents?
Sure, I'd be glad to. Now, first of all, let's back up a little bit and say that the military of today is far different from the military of Vietnam. The military of Vietnam had a small core active duty component and then a large number of single male draftees. The military of today is primarily married. 90% of the career force in the military is married. So basically, they're all parents, with the exception of those that are very young. So that is a big difference. The military has a policy that, and it's really a condition of employment. For those who are single parents and those who are dual military couples, they have a child care plan that they have to have, designating custody of the individual of their child in the event of deployment. By and large, this policy worked very well. There were some exceptions, particularly in the reserve component, but by and large, this policy worked very well. You may be interested to know that there are more male single parents in the military than there are female single parents. That's very different from the civilian sector.
So if you're married and your spouse is in the military too and you have children, or if you're a single parent, you're required to have a dependent care plan. You're required to have somebody who you could give your child required to have somebody who you could give custody of your child to if you're deployed.
That's correct.
So you think this is something that all military family people are told that they have to think about before?
Most definitely. The active component has been, all the active forces have had this policy in place for, I would say, at least 10 years. And they have been very firm about it. I think where the problem came was in the reserve component. First of all, the reserves never thought that they'd deploy. So even if it was a requirement for them, it didn't have the urgency. It was sort of, what are the odds I'm going to go? The odds are probably nil that I'm going to go. Well, all of a sudden, they mobilized many, many reserves who didn't ever think that they'd be mobilized.
You know, still, as a civilian, it's mm-hmm. easy to think, well, the military hasn't really quite thought through a family policy for the new volunteer army in which there are so many parents who are involved. I mean, I think it broke the hearts of so many people in the country to see mothers and fathers having to leave their children
right.
behind. And everybody was thinking about how many children could have been orphaned had the war turned out very differently than it did.
Sure. Well, you know, and this goes back to the fact that we as a nation don't have a family policy. The military actually has a better family policy than most. Military women have a 6 weeks maternity leave with full pay and a guarantee of their job back. That's all military women, enlisted and officers. And they have child care centers at local bases. So the military has attempted to deal with the child care issue. So they're, in many ways, they're ahead of the scale on a lot of these issues that have to do with family policy.
Well, now that the war is over and we've seen the way the family policy has worked, do you think that it's time to think about reform, or do you think that the war proved that the family policy works well?
I think the war proved that the family policy, by and large, worked well. I think that there will be modifications in their policy, and DOD has the power to do this. One of the things that they will do is that they will extend the period of time that a new mother has before she deploys. Right now, the Navy women had up to 4 months. Newborn mothers had up to 4 months before they deploy, but the Air Force and the Army women were to deploy after 6 weeks. I think what will happen is that they will extend that period to 6 months for all women in all services and standardize that. So, I think that that's very appropriate.
Carolyn Beecraft is my guest, and she established the Women in the Military Project for the Women's Research and Education Institute. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carolyn Beecraft. Now, you were an officer in the Army from 1966 to 1971.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was during the war in Vietnam.
Right.
The military was very different, and the war was a very different war than the one America just fought.
Yes.
What were some of your problems as an officer then? Some of the things you felt that you were up against as a woman?
Oh, it's really very interesting. First of all, there was by law a cap on the percentage of women that could be in the forces at 2%. So there were very few women that were in the military at that time. Mostly we were in the medical or administrative fields. I was in the medical field. For instance, I got pregnant. I married and I lost my entitlements, and I got pregnant and I lost my job. Those were all policies that the military had. You couldn't be married. A woman could not be married to another military member and still get her housing allowance, for instance. And a woman could not be married. She could be married later on, but she couldn't have a child. She would be discharged. That was totally different. The opportunities that the women have today, they can go into almost any field with certain exceptions. And all of those fields were not open in my day. You couldn't be a pilot, you couldn't be in logistics, you couldn't be in intelligence, communication, military police, any of those fields that are open to the women today. They were all closed to me.
Maybe you can explain for us a little bit more about what your role as an officer was in the medical part of the military.
Sure. I was a dietitian, and in my last two positions, I was chief of the food service division at two separate hospitals. That meant I had overall responsibility for all of the feeding of hospital patients and the dietary therapy. And in those days, that included those men who were wounded in the Vietnam War and came back to the various hospitals to recuperate.
So you were stationed in Vietnam?
I was stationed here in the United States in a number of different hospitals.
So when did you get back into the military, and were you ever able to get your position back?
No, I was never able to get it back. In fact, I didn't even have the opportunity to go in the reserves, because you couldn't go into the reserves either. I left in 1971.
Now, is what you were up against what drove you to start studying women's rights in the military?
Actually, it was. I did. I was getting my master's degree, and I had two choices of topics. One had to do with a nutrition topic, and the other was to measure the effects of the women's movement on wives of military officers, and I chose to do that one. And really, that began my work in the late 70s.
So what do you think the social factors have been, and economic factors that have really been responsible for the changes of women's roles in the military in the past few years?
Well, you know, you have to go back. The most important change was the end of the draft and the beginning of the all-volunteer force, because then the military had to start actively recruiting women, and they had to start opening up jobs for them in order to maintain the numbers that they needed. That corresponded, as I said before, with the changes that occurred in the civilian world, where all opportunities opened for civilian women also. So I think that is a major change. The changes in the 70s also had to deal with the entitlements and pregnancy, so it allowed women to remain in the service, to marry, to have a family, and still maintain their service career. You've had a number of firsts. You've got women that are doing absolutely incredible non-traditional things. And I think that the military always has legitimized the status of groups that do not have power. And I think that the women's performance in this war has legitimized their status, not only in the military, but as citizens in this country.
Now, I want to go back to when you were in the military.
Sure.
And you were up against all these things. Did you think it was unfair when you married and you lost your entitlements? And
oh, absolutely. I fought that.
How did you fight it? What kind of recourse did you have?
Oh, I had very little recourse, but I went up through the chain of command, and I went to the inspector general, and I wrote to Washington, and I was just outraged that could happen to me. But I did not file a suit. But the internal army processes did not support me.
Well, what was expected of the so-called military wife then?
Oh, I've been one of those too. The army had a saying that if the army wanted you to have a wife, they would have issued you one. And culturally, that still underlies a lot of their assumptions today. The role of the army spouse or the army wife was to provide social support to the wives of the men in her husband's unit. So she was basically supposed to provide social support, have teas and coffees, and keep them busy.
Boy, you must have really resented that after being an officer yourself to
I never
be expected
did well.
To do this.
I really, going from an active duty officer to a military spouse was and continues to be the most difficult transition I've ever made in my life.
Continues to be? Are you still expected to provide that kind of function?
Oh, it's still there. It's still there. I've gotten over it now. I deal with the system on the terms that are comfortable for me, and I have the support of my husband to do that. But it's been a long, hard struggle.
I guess I'm a little surprised because since there's so many dual military families now, where the husband and wife are both in the military, I would have thought that would have changed considerably for military wives.
But the military is a different kind of culture in that everybody that comes in at a certain time progresses at the same level in the same amount of time. So those in the senior leadership came in the 50s, and they are still acculturated that way. So there's a quite a generational difference present in the military, and there is in the military today. Young women do not feel the pressures that women my age felt. Or women my age still feel. They don't feel the pressures. They have a different value system, and the system expects different things of them. And I think that's partly because there are so many more military women now.
What are the issues you see yourself as lobbying around now? What do you think are the priorities, the next steps for women in the military?
Well, I think the most important next step, well, there are a couple of them. First of all, it needs to be documented exactly what the women did over in every service over there, because that's important. Always before in wars, when women came home and were discharged, their participation was not written into the history. So it's very important that occur. I also think for military women themselves that they have finally proven themselves to their system in the way that is meaningful to that system. That is, they went to war, they won a war, and their participation was as valid as their male counterpart. So they should get a certain self-confidence about that. I certainly hope that they have, because they certainly deserve that self-confidence to deal with their system and address their issues directly with the system. And I think that that will happen.
A lot of people in the American public were really focusing on this issue of seeing women separated from their children as the women went off to the war. I was wondering if you have a sense of how the women in the military were reacting to that on the whole. Are they afraid of any regulations that would make it more difficult for them to fight because it would be more difficult for them to achieve equal status?
Yeah, yes, they are. First of all, most of the military women I know, and I think that most of the women in the Persian Gulf would be quite appalled at the way the discussions have taken place over here, because basically you're questioning their responsibility as parents. I mean, that's how they see it. Military women do not want any kind of legislation, because the legislation proposed would affect men also, it would disproportionately, percentage-wise, affect them. And they don't want that at all. They feel that they have made their choice, they understand the condition of employment, and that they have made their arrangements for their children, and that they've taken care of the best interests of their children within the terms of their profession. And they really are not real happy with all of this discussion.
Well, Carolyn Beecraft, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Carolyn Beecraft is a military policy consultant in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.